Hi, everyone, and welcome back to our next episode of Three Sides to Every Adoption. I am really pleased to have the luxury of introducing our next guest with us today. It's Dr. Gordon Neufeld from the Neufeld Institute. I'm really lucky that I know him rather well. I've been on staff with the Neufeld Institute for almost a decade. And his insight has been crucial to me in helping me find my way as a parent, as well as coming out of what's commonly referred to as the adoption fog, or what Dr. Neufeld, you might call just the recovery of my feelings. But for others who might need an introduction, I will say that Dr. Neufeld brings over 50 years of experience as a clinical psychologist working with children and youth and those responsible for them. He's the best-selling author of the book, Hold On to Your Kids, published 16 years ago, still going strong after its initial publication, and translated into, I've lost count.
We added one more this morning.
Oh my gosh.
In Somali, yes.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's wonderful. Yeah, so many, many languages.
Yeah, about 30. 30 now.
30. Oh my gosh. He runs the Neufeld Institute, which delivers courses and conferences to parents, educators, and helping professionals. He's an international speaker, addressing child development issues in so many congresses and countries like Japan, Sweden, Israel, Portugal, European Union, New Zealand. I can't name them all, but around the world. And even recently supporting Ukrainian mothers with the trauma that their children are experiencing. You've been involved in various Aboriginal communities throughout Canada and the leading interpreter of the developmental paradigm, the perspective of which we'll be talking about today. So Dr. Neufeld, it's just a real honor that you're with us. We're so happy to have you here.
Well, I'm pleased to be invited, pleased to join you. And hi, Lori. Hi, Kelsey. Great to be here.
Thank you. I think what we will do, I was thinking of how to start this conversation, and I think maybe the best way is to just talk about, on a broader level, for those who aren't familiar, what an attachment-based developmental paradigm is, and how it might help us with the understanding of the children in our care, particularly in the case we're talking about for these conversations, for adoptees. I think just a little background I wanted to say is that we tend to get kind of on this loop of needing to prove that adoption is traumatic. It's so often skirted over or not recognized. And yet there are really profound losses that come with adoption all around that have really real consequences. And so what I think we end up, because we're still so needing to prove that adoption is loss and trauma, that we get kind of stuck on a loop of that. And what I really appreciated about your work, Dr. Neufeld, is that you lend insight into adoption and stuckness and how to find our way through, how to recover from that. So I would just love to just hear your thoughts on just what is attachment-based developmental paradigm and how can it help when we're talking about adoption?
Well, it certainly has the answers to why it can be so traumatic. And why it's so hard to adapt to. So hopefully we'll be able to get that in. But the attachment-based developmental approach, in a developmental approach, of course, you're always looking to how things form. But contrary to how it's used today where development just has to do with children, this is actually an approach in which there is the understanding that development would unfold spontaneously, like it would in a plant. It unfolds spontaneously. It's not a matter of skill if conditions are conducive. So it's all about what conditions are conducive. And so that is the look and the realization that one of the primary conditions is that the rootedness is continuous. Is that is what the attachment is about, just like a plant. is that the growth will not happen if the roots are having difficulty. And of course, that's where adoption comes in. And adoption comes in from being one of the earliest, in a sense, and one of the primary disruptions of continuity, of connection, but it lasts throughout life. And that's what people don't understand, is it doesn't end right after adoption, is that facing separation is developmental, and it will be there till the day you die. And so that's important to understand as well, instead of an event that happens in real time. A developmentalist is a generalist, always, because it's all about seeing the biggest picture rather than going down rabbit holes. So true developmentalists don't tend to be experts or advertise themselves as experts, because we believe we have more to offer to, for instance, the autism spectrum, if we can see the big picture rather than go and look at it specifically. And the same is true for whether it's children of divorce, transplanting children, whether it is dealing with aggression and violence, the same is true all the way. And that of course applies to adoption as well.
Great. I appreciate that. And there's just something, you just reminded me, Gordon, of when I first, excuse me, Dr. Neufeld.
Gordon is fine. You gave me such a royal introduction. Now I have to kind of feel so good. Gordon is fine.
Thank you. We'll go on a first name basis. Just the power of, for me, what has been so remarkable about your work is just the words and thus the consciousness, and just even as I felt myself just sigh in relief when you said that the facing of a separation lasts a lifetime, because it's like, yes. And you said it so succinctly. It's like this, like, feels so complicated inside, and it's how do you, but then you just say it with, well, that was only a few words. So it's just so helpful and refreshing. So thank you. and I would love to hear you talk more about facing separation. I know you have a lot to say there about stress and what stress is and how it relates to separation and adoption, how that relates to separation. So would you mind talking more about that?
Certainly. And I'll try to be brief, after creating whole courses around this, and then, try to do the elevator speech bit, pretend I'm on the news or so. And I used to have to say things in, you have a minute. But the idea of that facing separation, first of all, it is the ultimate threat. We used to think that it was threats to survival, that was it. But the biggest discovery of attachment theory, and by theory it doesn't mean it's not a science, of attachment science, was the fact that survival is not actually a drive. We're not driven to survive. We're driven for togetherness. We're driven for connection. Just like our neurons are driven for connection. When they connect, they survive. When we connect, we survive. Everything in the fetus is driven towards connection. When it connects, it survives. And so everything is about togetherness, and survival is the result of it. So that understanding alone would tell you that adoption is a struggle at the level of survival. And that gives you an appreciation of just how deep it goes. And that isn't appreciated because, if you are adopted at birth, it's just assumed that, there should be no trauma. This is continuous and so on and so on. It's not like that. There's already been 9 months of seeking togetherness and fusion with the maternal host. There's already the music in the voice, the rhythm, all of these things, and music and patterns are the first way the fetus, the baby, attaches, the the unborn attaches. And so all of this already forms. Why? Because it is survival. And so when you get that, you get at how deeply it is when there's disruptions in this connection. The other thing to realize is that there's layer upon layer upon layer of togetherness. Togetherness for the neurons and for the fetus starts with an actual physical connection. It is through senses, primarily through, through touch and so on. There, smell develops, and so on. Of course, hearing develops well in there, but it's primarily through the senses, and it continues that way in infancy. But then there is layer upon layer of sameness. And that plays a huge part in adoption, because this whole quest for sameness, but I'm different, but you know, who are my people, and what, where do my nose come from? And you know, all of those things about sameness, and then sameness in all kinds of areas. And then it goes to belonging. And of course that becomes an issue. And then it goes to a sense of significance, mattering. And this is where, at about 3 or 4 years of age, it's like, you want to matter. And then comes the doubts, but did I matter more? Why? You know, and then all of a sudden there's this sense, but I was supposed to matter the most. Why didn't I matter the most? What could get in the way of mattering the most? And so that's part of, and that gives a whole layer of insecurity. And then, of course, then it goes into emotional intimacy, and then sharing all that is within my heart. But already you're so full of thoughts and feelings, and it's very hard to share, because if you share these things, it insults your relationship with your adopted mother. And so there's insecurities with this. And so it stymies, you know, it is there. And then it just, then you see, when you understand how, what togetherness is about, you understand the various areas of facing separation. So now it's your wedding day, and you are walking down the aisle. And as you start to walk down the aisle, you've arranged it, you've choreographed everything, everything is fine. You go, I wonder who my dad is. You know, I wonder what this is. Oh, I wish my mom was here now. And you have all of these kinds of things. And then it continues on through your own birth and all of it. You see what I mean? It just is that constant ricochet of that, something that goes as deep as, why didn't I matter most? Invited into the presence of this, as deep as this, or who am I the same as? Who are my people? And goes all the way to the sense of being seen and heard from the inside out. So the facing separation is a life of the adoptee. It is the life. And when you understand it's not an event, when you understand it's a life, then you can lean into it. It is part of the challenge, as part of the specialness of this journey. And but it cannot be escaped. To escape it would be to escape all the feelings that are very, very important to you.
That so informs our adoption practice, specifically with domestic infant adoption, as you're talking about this connection. Because I think the practice has been, in order to prevent pain, let's prevent that connection between expectant mom and baby. Because if we can prevent the connection, we can prevent the emotions and prevent the pain. And we do things.
That's so reductionistic, that thinking. You know, that is so reductionistic. It just is this like, okay. You know, I mean, and the whole thing is about, you see, even the idea, and this is why we have to be very careful about not delivering this into the hands of medicine, of doctors. And that would be whether it's through the Diagnostic Statistic Manual, whatever it is, you must stay out of that arena, because that arena is about pain and pleasure only. Whatever is pain, we must avoid. Whatever is pleasure, we do this. And if it's pain, we numb it. That would be a dreadful thing for that to happen, because if you fight the pain of being adoptee, you will never adapt. There is a pain that is inevitable. Now, there's a pain for all kinds of things. Some people are born with different kinds of pains, a brain that doesn't work properly, a way too overwhelmed. Everybody has a pain, but to being an adoptee, there is this kind of thing too, but it's not to be run from, it's not to be escaped. So yeah, just to underscore what you were saying. Underscore, exclamation mark, whatever you do with that yellow pen,
I interviewed Dr. Marcy Axness, who was herself an adoptee, for my book on this issue about connecting pre-birth between mom and baby. And she was saying that the grief can be cleaner the more solid the connection is.
Yeah.
and that the grieving process is harder if the mom is encouraged not.
That's an important insight. And we can unpack this basically, but from where I stand, adoption is primarily an issue of adaptation. You have a challenge of human adaptation. And so it's all about the process of that adaptation. Now, for adaptation to happen, you have to feel the futility of the fix. So our brain is always trying to fix something. It has to feel its way through the world. Our brain does. It doesn't think its way through. It has to feel its way. Adaptation is not a process of thinking. It's feeling. And you have to feel the fix. Now, let me just give an example. Braden, he's 30 now, but when he was 4 years of age, my youngest son, my father, his grandfather, who we call Grandpa, died. And my mother was having a really difficult time. And so she's sitting at the dinner and we're saying grace, and she bursts into tears and she apologizes. And Braden, my four-year-old, says to my mother, his grandmother, Granetti, he calls her Granetti, "Granetti, it's okay. You have to let yourself feel the shape of the hole that Grandpa left. The only thing that can fill that hole is tears. So it's okay." Now, he was spot on. He was absolutely on. The fact is the more you feel the shape of the hole, the more you realize there is nothing that can fix this but having tears, because nobody could have filled the shape of the hole. What is the problem in most adoptions? In adoptions, you don't get to be 4 years of age, have exactly the hole that mother, the attachment hole that would be left. So the hole is vague, it's amorphous. And if it's vague and amorphous, if you can't define that hole and you don't know what it is that is that feeling, you either eat too much or you fill it with this or that, but it doesn't, you don't get the sense there's nothing left to do but cry. And if there's and so there's all kinds of things to do to feel this kind of thing, you don't know what it's about. And so that's why adoption is so difficult. It's like trauma. It's not just about what has happened to us. It is mostly about what didn't happen within us in our response. And that's the grieving, feeling the futility of the fix. But to feel the futility of the fix, you've got to actually feel the shape of the whole. And that actually takes a while. You know, and to feel the shape of the whole, to validate it with oneself, because nobody has any patience in this world. They all want things to get better very quickly. No, you've got nothing to complain about. Look what, you know, what is et cetera. And it's all supposed to be over. And this shape of the whole actually forms throughout life. And if it forms throughout life, so does the futility of filling that hole with anything else but tears form throughout life. And so it's a life of grieving. Now, one would say, well, that's dreadful. That's so dreadful. No, because a life that has a thread of sadness in it, a life that the sadness is a thread that brings things together, brings out the greatest potential in us as humans, because it is the pathway of adaptation, of the realization of potential. So in some ways, you could say, you know, in some ways, well, the adoptee has a wonderful kind of prompter, primer, catalyst, you know, something like that, to truly become all that they could be, because they can't escape this. You know, it cannot be escaped. And if it cannot be escaped, then you best face it. You face it and you take it as a life. There's so many things about being Black in a white community, about being you could go on and on and on about all the kinds of misfits that happen that there's no escape from.
The word I was good, when you were looking for that word, I was thinking superpower, you know?
Yeah, right.
Like, maybe that's my pride, but it's like, yeah.
Well, super catalyst anyway, right?
Super catalyst.
Yes. I mean, whether it empowers you is whether you walk that life, but it's a super catalyst. It's there. It's there. You have, in a sense, the philosopher's stone, if you're thinking alchemy wise. Okay, it's right here, is that you walk this life of experiencing the shape of the whole that begins to form, and you have the adaptation that brings you into all that you could be.
Yeah, Gordon, thank you so much for that. I mean, I feel like you were in my head there, explaining my whole life. So I just really appreciate that. And I do think I was just, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, these temptations that we have as adoptees, and maybe others in the triad experiences too. I think I'd love to hear from Kelsey and Lori on that. But just, I think, you know, I came from a closed adoption. So the temptation is to think, oh, I just need to find my birth family.
Yes, yes, that's all we see. Idea. If only, yes.
That brain just kind of, oh, I'm going to fix this.
Yeah, see, and it's so hard to feel the futility of a fix when you go, but if only, you know, and when you've got, you know, you're so brilliant, Sarah, when you've got a head full of intelligence, a brain to apply to this, you know, it occurs to you that there's, you know, like, if only I overturn this rock or this here or look here, yes. Yeah.
And you don't get to it. You're still adopted. You still have that.
Yeah. At the end of the day, the invitation that we all yearn for, to exist in the presence, you know, of who gave birth to us, and for that to be a lifelong invitation, and to be cherished and loved, there's a sting. And, you know, regardless of how we adapt, there's a melancholy.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I think I'd love to turn it over to Kelsey now, because my heart is kind of going there, just thinking about how this lands for you, Kelsey. And you face separation in a really big way from the birth parents' perspective. So, Kelsey, do you have...
All this has been super eye-opening. I think I also have spent the past 5 years working in adoption. So a lot of this stuff, it's like I've saw some variation of or talked to parents about in some form or another. But it's it's always so wonderful to hear from a credible source. And sometimes I kind of feel like we know what we feel and the experience. And like Sarah said earlier, like we know adoption is trauma, but having to argue about that very simple notion seems so counterproductive sometimes, because we want to move past that and we want to move into helping parents and helping adoptees and helping birth parents move into like a healing phase. And and sometimes arguing over that simple thing is just like, okay, if you don't get it, like, yeah, go and come back later.
Yeah, before there's a healing, you have to accept that there's an owie.
Yeah.
There's a big owie.
But I think for my own personal experience as being a birth mother, I like hearing you talk about the fix and stuff. I think it earlier and I'm only 6 years post-placement, but I would say even just a few years ago, I'm a very like ambitious person. And I would think, okay, if I just, you know, have a good career and, you know, make something of myself, then maybe my son won't be upset or mad at me or think, or he'll want to have a relationship with me because I'm not a scary person or I'm not, I don't know, this is all the stereotypes, I guess. I'm not the stereotype. But then I sort of realized pretty quickly that there's not a fix for that. And to have a good relationship, you have to work on the relationship and not not just these menial things. So, but I also, in terms of like having a fix for the separation, I think I've always kind of known that there's no fix for my side. Like in the farther I get in this post-placement life for myself, I am very understanding that like forever is a long time. And this arrangement, this life, as you said, is a long, long time, and it lasts for a lifetime and beyond, because also I'm the fourth generation in my family to relinquish. And my dad's an adoptee and his birth mom was an adoptee. And it has effects long after your lifetime as well, because now you have all of these severed branches of your family tree and just generational trauma and separation. And it's difficult to navigate, so.
Mm-hmm. And so it is a lifelong journey too, where the healing actually is open to the sadness involved and not trying to run away from that sense of something missing. It's natural for a mother, very, when the attachment forms, a radar forms. And it's one of the most difficult things. When you love somebody, they're on your radar. And when they're on your radar, it hurts like anything to know. I yesterday, my oldest daughter, who's well in her 50s, she was flying to Saskatoon, and I knew that she doesn't enjoy flying all that much, and she had work to do. And so here she is, you know, this is well over 50 years after she's been born, but she's on my radar. And so I, like, you know, I finally call her, but I could call her. And that's the point. When you have a radar that has been formed out of this attachment, and there is a vagueness about it, you know that it should be filled in with the details. There is something that is missing. There is something that is thwarted in the maternal caring instinct, or the paternal, mom or dad. Radar isn't just a mom thing. but that too is a life of you never know when that thought comes. I wonder, You never know. And opening to this and letting it, again, letting a little bit of sadness come mm-hmm. from this is a life of healing. It is knowing that there is this melancholy thread that is the tapestry of your life, and it is part of who you are, and you don't have to fight it. And when that becomes part of who you are, it isn't so scary anymore.
Right. Yeah.
I want to explore that sadness a little bit more, because I think from parents' perspectives, from adoptive parents' perspectives, we really get uncomfortable when our child might feel sad, and we go to great lengths to prevent them from feeling sad, distracting, being overly positive, all the strategies to keep them from feeling sad, perhaps because we don't want to trigger our own sadness within. So can you talk more about that emotional piece? And I also want to ask, is sadness the root of all the other emotions that we don't want to look at? Anger and grief and sorrow?
It's not the root, it's the end of. It's what sadness is in the brain. The brain feels the futility of an emotion that was supposed to fix something, like frustration, like anger, like guilt, like shame, like pursuit, like alarm. These emotions are all meant, these are all evoked when there is disruption to togetherness, when we face up, because that is at the survival level, that must be fixed. And so the brain throws these emotional solutions to it, and it doesn't stop. Once they are charged with, they have their commission, they're literally electricity in the brain. Once they're charged, they seek expression. Now the question is how do they know that they can rest now? How do they know that it's over now? How does the sentence come to an end? How does the commission come to the end? Well, the only way it comes to an end is that the brain actually feels the futility of the fix. And that is where sadness comes in. That's the best word we have. Is for big sadness, it's grieving, mourning, sorrow, all of those kinds of things. But the everyday experience of futility is you feel disappointed, you feel sad that something couldn't have worked. Now, you feel mad when something doesn't work, but you feel sad when it couldn't work. That is, you see the difference. You're mad when you still think something could be done. You're angry when you think somebody else could make it better. You feel guilty when you think I could still make it better. These are all unfinished business. And so the brain is full of unfinished business. And what adoption does is fill the brain with all kinds of unfinished business. And because it fills it with all of these emotional solutions that need to be fixed in some way. And there is a sense, a deep sense in the psyche, that you've got to make something better, or somebody has to make something better, or something. There's this unease that is there, that it is. Now, the only solutions, because the brain can't think it doesn't matter how smart you are, you can't say, well, you know, my mother couldn't help it. There was nothing that could be done. This was already planned. This was the idea. And, you know, actually, she sacrificed her life for me. And so you have all of these ideas that you can do there to try and answer it. The brain doesn't get it because it has to feel its way through. And so that's why sadness comes in. And sadness is extremely important. Now, when because sadness is the end of the sentence, it puts a period on it. It says, the brain says, oh, I get it. It couldn't be fixed. And that is where the release is. That's where the rest is. And so that's where the rest and the melancholy. Sadness is the most important emotion. Most important human emotion of all. It is so terrible that it's become pathologized, and that we see it as almost evil, as something that, you know, is wrong, because it is life, and And we have good reason for it. And the adoptee has a very good reason. And the mother who gave up the child, the same is true. The very same is true. It's just two ends, but it's the same walk. It's the same process. And so sadness isn't the root of every emotion. It should be the fruit of every emotion. It is the end point, right? It should come to fruition in sadness, which is a victory cry of the brain. When it actually gets to sadness, the brain goes, we've survived. So it's a victory cry. The problem was not fixed, was converted to sadness. And so resilience is born out of this, and we walk the maze. And so it continues on, but it's a lifelong process. So it is our friend, and we needn't be afraid of it. And young children cry naturally and spontaneously. I think they must sense how afraid we are as adults to fight it in themselves. Because when they're young, you know, often my young ones or even grandchildren would say, "Thank you, Papa, so much for letting me cry. I just needed to cry." There is this sense that, you know, they know more than we do. They know that it is a natural part of life and not to be afraid of, but somehow we screw them up, you know, by our own neuroses about it.
Gordon, what advice would you give? And I think I know some of this, but so it's a leading question, but, you know, for adults to get comfortable and to help their adopted children with that grieving. And, you know, maybe you can speak about the power of play.
Well, I will go to play. Like, if you think of sadness as being the most important thing, what is the thing that will make you sad when you don't know why you are sad? And, you know, what has the power to actually find that sadness in us? It's music. And what kind of music is actually designed to bring us to that sadness and make it easy to bear? The lullaby for the baby, the lament for the aged. And somewhere in between, you have both. So what would you be singing? What would you be doing for both yourself and the baby? What would you pass along if this was an arranged adoption from a birth mom to an adoptee mom, the lullaby that goes with the baby? That brings to the sadness, the melancholy that both can dance to, that both can feel the fusion of it. Like, if you want some practical advice, something as practical as practical, to the oldest solution, you know, for our oldest parenting practices are the lullaby. We have lullabies written over 6,000 years ago that are still in existence. Why? Because what is what we all need? What does the birth mother need to not go into postnatal depression? There is something about this that we don't give any room for a mother after birth. She's supposed to be happy and celebrate. And there's something inside of her that just wants to cry and cry and cry, and she doesn't know why. And so the lullaby would be, you know, that place. I mean, you just go to this and you realize, oh, this would be this is where culture comes in, and it gives the traditions of sadness. It gives the rituals of sadness. It gives the liturgy of sadness. If you want to bring in a religious word to this, the liturgy of sadness, and it elevates it to the place where it's part of life. And we should have never been this taken away from us. And this needs to be, and when there are difficulties, it should even be more applied. And so we would have those things. So I forget what your question was, Sarah, but I got taken away. Why, what you said, play, why did I go to this? Well, because you see, music is an emotional playground. And so it's play for the brain. It doesn't count for real. unless we're practicing an instrument and, you know, for an outcome. But if it's not outcome based, you know, it's an emotional playground. And this is the kind of play, not playing with the little toys. That's important for the, you know, all of this. No, emotional play is what a child needs already at birth. In fact, before birth, there should have been that emotional playground, as well as a lullaby is the best way of being able to make that kind of connection. So play becomes very important, and accessing sadness for which we have no words. And that is the big issue, you see. If you have to feel the shape of a hole, you have to feel something that is words. What about all of this stuff about adoption is stuff without words? That's the problem. Words are required to come to consciousness, and all of this is without words. And what is it that we have without words? Then we need music. We can't expect fetuses to draw. We can't expect, you know, to sculpt. They can't do theater. All of these are growing up, or they have to get older to do these things. Music is the only thing that was here before us, and it will be here long after us. It predates us by about 50 million years in the humpback whale, who uses music also for emotional health and well-being. So one of the most important playgrounds that we're not using, and the most important playground for melancholy, for sadness, because it legitimizes it. It makes it easy to feel. We don't need any words, and it joins two people together.
You've just made sense of my teenage angsty years, where I was in a dark room listening to sad music. Just made it all make sense. And also, just because we're recording this in the wake of the Uvalde tragedy, you've given me a tool to access my emotions and help my children too.
That's exactly
it. And love people I love.
Yeah.
Speaking of music too, just, I think you just explained some things to me that, you know, I think everyone here knows that I also run the Adoptive Voices writing groups, and advice I give to writers all the time is something that worked for me, that I don't even think until I heard you speaking just now, Gordon, that I understood why I was doing it. But, you know, I think for me, in writing my memoir about adoption and making sense of it, my technique was to just, I would find a song that fit each chapter and I would play it loud in my ears on repeat, where it just absorbed in me. And I was just channeling, kind of.
Yeah, though it takes you to a different level, doesn't it? It does. It actually what they find out is when the music is at play, it takes you to, instead of into the neural grooves, where all the stuckness is, it takes you on top where all the plasticity is. And so it actually elevates you. So what you discovered was an absolute, it's the best way that you could find the greatest creativity.
I just got goosebumps. That's amazing. Yeah. Oh, really fun. Really fun. I mean, music is fun. It's, and I say fun, it's, which seems light, I guess. As I say that, I'm thinking, oh, but we're talking about grief and
humor. Yeah, but you have to let you have to let music do its work. Like, we, you know, the most important things we can use for the wrong reasons, food, you know, like we can abuse, right? And music is the same. We can use music to escape. And if we use it to escape rather than to feel, it will take us exactly away from where we need to go. So we actually have to be willing for music to find what it needs to find. And if we are willing to do this, I think of sad music, the lullaby, the lament. It was actually the same root word in some languages, lament and lullaby, it's the sweeper of stale emotion. Like it looks for unfinished business in the brain of emotions that have to come to an end point. And so it's that end point. It's, again, not the root, but the fruit. It's that end point that music helps. Okay. Move on to the business. And if it really moves you, you start feeling your eyes water. There is something that happens in you, and you go, oh, this is where I need to be. It is okay. This is where where restoration happens. I, you know, and it's universally accessible. You don't have to pay $250 an hour for therapy for it.
I have a music degree, and I've played the clarinet for oh my God, I don't even know how many years, since I was 11. So quite a long, I mean, I'm 29, so I'm not that old, but I have played it for a very long time. And I remember in college, I struggled so badly with depression, and, but the, my turning point for me, which until you just said that, it never clicked for me. But as I was preparing for my senior recital, junior year was really, really tough for me. And then the fall of my senior year, it was just a huge turnaround for me. And I've never been able to put my finger on what exactly that was. But I remember preparing for my senior recital in the morning and at night. And at night I would sneak into the recital hall. And so that I could play to a big empty room in the middle of the night and play my clarinet and play my pieces and everything. And I always remember it being very, it's emotional, but I don't remember like having like tears or anything, but it was so soothing to me to play to a big empty room. And
because it didn't count.
You could feel it. And I guess that makes so much sense to me why that was such a turning point semester for me. Because I just was able to really have that therapeutic time. Yeah. And
And that's when music does its work, when it doesn't count, when it's not for outcome. So what you thought you were doing is practicing, what an actual thing was happening is music says, now we've got her. Now we can do what's necessary, bring her to rest, you know, give her some.
I'm like, okay, I got to find a practice room. I'm just parent and toddler, and I don't really get the chance to play all that much, but I'm like, oh my God, I got to go do that now.
Yes.
It would help me so much. So.
Yeah. My daughter was in her third year and in oboe in music and, you know, starting to get ready for her performance, right? Your performing recital. But then something shifted inside of her that she couldn't find the emotional expression she needed in the oboe, although it's a gorgeous instrument. I love it. But she found that all her time was in reed making and you know, got quite obsessive with it. So she changed to the voice and she found her voice and all the emotion in the voice. And literally her personality changed when she was able to find that expression that she needed in it. And she's still a professional musician today too, as well. Choral conductor.
I'm loving this conversation. I want to go get some music on. And I think one thing I just feel like we should point out is this is for all ages. I think you said that.
Yes. It is a walk. And it's not something you get over. When you're trying to get over, you don't get it. It is a walk and it is okay. And we all feel holes of different kinds. And some are wordless, some have words, you know, et cetera. And there is this, and so it is okay. And once you accept it as a walk, there are silver linings that you experience as a result of it, as well. But yes, it's the idea that it's something you get over it is not only a false hope, it turns it to an outcome kind of thing where you're trying to get someplace instead of to be in that.
Well, and I think for adoptees, and I'll speak for myself, just there's, and I feel I can say this with confidence, just knowing how many adoptees I think are, we lose our feelings because of all of the defenses. Our brain, as I love how you've often said, our brain has its reasons. And so it's doing that for protection, but just the ways that we lose our feelings.
Yeah.
And that's why the music is so important to help us.
Yeah.
To feeling. Well, there's so much more I feel like we could get to, but I think this has just been a beautiful, just, and really important conversation about our brains and adoption and the separation and the way through. And Gordon, I'll put it to you. Is there anything else that you would like to add in terms of this none of us have asked you yet?
No, it's just, it's not something to be afraid of. It's something to embrace. Whatever has happened, it's not what happens to us where the whole story is. It's about again our own response to it. And so we have talked, we've covered a lot of territory. So I can't think of anything at the moment that I want to add to it, although I'm sure as soon as we're finished I will, we'll think of several things that I wish I would have said this, but right now no.
Yeah, and I will too. We could keep you on here all day, so and pepper you with questions, so we'll just have to have you come back a different time and do that, because I think I think this conversation has been the perfect overview, and I think there's so many other places to go too that we could potentially talk about in the future. Discipline when it comes to adoptees and how sensitive we are to separation already, and
yes,
discipline does tend to be separation based, and some of our, speaking of culture, so much of our culture has lost its way and just forcing separation at children, which yes. Isn't good for any child, and especially not good for adoptees. So, but I don't want to go down there because I feel like we just,
yes.
Yeah. Kept such a strong container.
Plenty more to cover, but those are different chapters.
Yes. Yes. I do want to give a plug for a few things. I think just one more plug for your book, Hold On to Your Kids, national bestseller. Also, Dr. Gabor Maté, who's a friend and colleague of yours and co-author, a contributor to this book. So definitely an important read for all parents and all humans, I think, if I can be that bold. And we just finished the annual Neufeld Conference, and the video recordings of that are available at the Neufeld Institute for $180. So I just want to give a plug for that, because there's some really, the whole theme of the conference this year was bouncing back, recovering from stress and trauma. So
it's all quite relevant.
Yeah.
Yes. And I've got four or five talks in there, the anchor keynote and the talks, but I think there's 40 some recordings all available. So yes, it's a treasure trove.
Yeah, really is. And then of course you've got really great courses that are applicable to all parenting, back to your developmentalist approach, not specializing, but you're making sense of discipline course, the play course.
That's what I do. I make courses, right? That's what I do. Yes. Yeah. I'm a course maker. Yeah.
So, okay. Anything else, Lori and Kelsey, before we wrap up? Okay. Well, thank you again, Gordon. We really appreciate your time, and we'd love to have you back again.
My absolute pleasure, and it's a wonderful thing that you're doing. Well needed to speak to the validity that there is something that needs to be attended to and opened up to, and to let ourselves feel. Yeah. Good. All the best.